My lords, as you can see by these charts, since we left the Second Cataract, we have travelled nearly 1,000 miles. But we stand now not much more than a few hundred miles from the point of our departure. Kratos rose to his feet to ask a question that I had placed in his mouth before the meeting began. Does this mean that it should be possible to take this shortcut across the desert and reach the Second Cataract in the same time as it takes to travel from Thebes to the Red Sea and return? I have made that journey several times. I turned to him. I was your companion on that same journey. 10 days in each direction it took us, and we did not have horses then. The crossing of this narrow strip of desert would be no more onerous. It means that from here one could be back in the city of Elephantine within a few short months, and it would be necessary to transit only the first cataract at Aswan. There was a buzz of comment and amazement. The maps were passed from hand to hand and scrutinized avidly. The entire mood of the assembly changed as I watched. There was a pathetic eagerness amongst all of them to accept my theory. This unexpected proximity to home and the land they knew cheered all of them. Only Acre and his friends were out of countenance. He had been deprived of the top dice in the game he was playing, as I had hoped he would do. He rose angrily to his feet now to put the next question to me. How accurate are the slaves' scribblings? His tone was offensive and his expression haughty. It is a simple matter to make a few pen strokes on a scroll. But when those are turned into miles of sand and rock, it is another matter entirely. How will the slave prove that these wild theories of his are fact? My Lord Acre has come to the very heart of the matter, my mistress intervened pleasantly, and in so doing has proven his astute grasp of the problem that faces us. I intend to send an expedition of good men to cross the neck of the desert and to open up our return route to the north, the road home to beautiful Thebes. I saw Ecker's expression change suddenly as he caught the slant of the Queen's speech and realized the trap that had been set for him. He sat down again hurriedly and tried to appear remote and disinterested. However, my mistress continued remorselessly. I was undecided as to who was best suited to lead this expedition, but now Lord Acre has, by his perception and understanding, proposed himself for this vital task. Is that not the case, my lord? She asked sweetly, and then went on smoothly before he could refuse. We are grateful to you, Lord Acre. You are to have whatever men and equipment you require. I command that you make your departure before the next full moon. The moon will make it easier for you to travel during the night and so avoid the heat of the day. I will send with you men who are able to navigate by the stars. You could win through to the Second Cataract and be back here before the end of the month, and if you succeed, I will place the gold of praise upon your shoulders. Lord Acre stared at her with open mouth, and he was still sitting rigid with shock on his stool after all his companions had dispersed. I fully expected him to find some excuse to back out of the task that we had tricked him into. But in the end he surprised me by coming to me to ask for my advice and help in arranging the scouting party. It seemed that I might have misjudged him, and that now he had been given some worthwhile mission, there was a chance that he would change from a troublemaker to a useful member of the company. I selected some of our best men and horses for him, and gave him 5 of our most sturdy carts, which could carry water skins that, if used sparingly, would last them for 30 days. By the time the full moon came around, Acre was quite cheerful and optimistic, and I felt guilty about having minimized the distance and the hazards of the journey. When the expedition set out, I went a short way into the desert with them to point them on the right road, and then I stood alone and watched them merge into the silvery moonlit wastes, aimed at that set of stars we call the Lute, which marks the northern horizon. I thought of Acre every day over the weeks that followed while we lay below the Fourth Cataract, and I hoped that the map I had given him was not as inaccurate as I feared it was. At least the immediate threat of a rebellion had disappeared with him into the north. While we waited, we planted our crops on the cleared islands and the river banks. However, the lie of the land was steeper than at the other sites lower down the river. It was more difficult to raise the water to irrigate our crops, and I could see that the quantity and the quality of the harvest must suffer in consequence. Naturally, we had set up the traditional shadoofs on their long, counterbalanced arms to lift the water from the river. These were worked by a slave who swung the clay pot at the end of the arm into the water and then lifted and spilled it into the irrigation ditch on the bank. It was a slow and back-breaking task. When the bank was high, as it was here, it was also an extremely wasteful method of collecting water. Each evening, Memnon and I drove our chariot along the river bank, and I was troubled by the paucity of the harvest that we watched growing there. We had many thousands of mouths to feed, and cornmeal was still the staple of our diet. I foresaw a time of famine unless we were able to bring more water to the fields. I do not know what made me think of the wheel for this purpose, except that the science of the wheel had by this time become an obsession and a passion in my life. I was still plagued by the problem of the bursting of the wheels of our chariots. My dreams were filled with turning and spinning and shattering wheels, wheels with bronze knives on the rim or with flags to measure the distance run, large wheels and small. The images haunted me and troubled my sleep. I had heard from one of the priests of Hapi that some varieties of timber could be made harder and more resilient by soaking them in water for a long period, so I was driven to experiment with this idea. As we were lowering one of the chariot wheels into the river for this purpose, the current played on the rim began to turn the wheel on its hub. I watched this idly, but as the wheel sank lower in the water, the movement ceased, and I thought no more about it. Some days later, one of the small boats crossing between the islands capsized, and the two men in it were swept into the rapids and drowned. Memnon and I watched this tragedy from the bank, and we were both distressed by it. I took the opportunity to warn the prince once more of the danger and the power of the river. "It is so strong that it will even turn the wheel of a chariot." "I don't believe you, Tata. You are saying that to frighten me. You know how I love to swim in the river." So I arranged an exhibition for him, and we were both duly impressed by the wheel turning, seemingly of its own accord, when it was dipped into the running water. "It would go faster, Tata, if it had paddles fixed around the rim," Memnon gave his opinion at last, and I stared at him in wonder. He was a little over 10 years old at the time, and yet he saw all things with a fresh and inquiring eye. By the time the full moon came around again, we had built a wheel driven by the river which lifted the water in a series of small baked clay jars and spilled it into a canal lined with clay tiles at the top of the high Nile bank. Even with her big belly, my mistress came ashore to watch this wondrous contraption. She was delighted by it. "You are so clever with the things you do with water, Taita," she told me. "Do you remember the water stool you built for me at Elephantine?" "I could make another for you now, if only you would allow us to live in a decent home like civilized people." Tanus was similarly impressed with the water wheel, though, of course, he would not show it. Instead, he grinned at me. "Very clever. But when will it burst like one of your famous chariot wheels?" he demanded. And Kratos and those other military oafs thought that was hugely funny. Thereafter, whenever a chariot wheel broke, they said that it had gone Tata, the pet name that the prince called me. Despite this levity, the fields of Dura soon grew dense and green in the loamy soil on the high banks, and the ears of golden corn drooped heavily in the bright Nile sunlight. This was not the only harvest that we gathered in at the Fourth Cataract. Queen Lostris gave birth to another little royal princess. If anything, the infant was more exquisite than her elder sister. It was passing strange that Princess Bekata was born with a cap of golden red curls. Her divine and ghostly father, Pharaoh Mimosa, had been of a swarthy cast, and her mother's hair was dark as the wing of a black eagle. No one could think of any reason for this aberrant coloration, but all agreed how pretty it was. Princess Bekata was 2 months old when the Nile began to rise once more, and we made our preparation for the transit of the Fourth Cataract. By now we were experienced in what had become an annual labor, and we had learned every trick and artifice to beat the rapacious river. We had not yet begun the transit when there was a tremendous excitement in the encampment. I heard the shouting and the cheering from the far bank of the river, where Prince Memnon and I were inspecting the horses and making certain that all was ready for the ascent of the cataract. We hurried back to the boats and crossed to the east bank to find the camp in an uproar. We pushed our way through the crowds, who were all waving palm fronds and singing the songs of welcome and honour. At the centre of all this we found a small caravan of battered wagons and skeletal horses, and a band of lean, travel-hardened veterans, burned black by the sun and tempered by the desert. "Seth, damn you and that map of yours, Taita," Lord Acker shouted at me from the leading wagon. "I don't know which of you lies worst. It was almost twice as far as you promised us." "Did you truly reach the north side of the river loop?" I shouted back at him, hopping with excitement and trying to fight my way through the crowd. "There and back," he laughed, mightily pleased with his accomplishment. "We camped at the second cataract and dined on fresh fish from the Nile. The road back to Thebes is open." My mistress ordered a feast to welcome back the travellers, and Lord Acker was the man of the day. At the height of the celebration, Queen Lostres placed the gold of praise around his neck and promoted him to the rank of best of 10,000. My gorge rose to see the fellow preen and strut. As if that was not enough, she gave him command of the 4th Division of Chariots and issued him a warrant that would entitle him to 100 feddan of prime land on the riverbank when we returned to Thebes. I thought all this a little excessive, especially the gift of so much land which must come out of my mistress's own estate. After all, Acker had been on the brink of mutiny, and though his achievement had been laudable, it was I who had proposed and planned the expedition. In the circumstances, it seemed to me that another gold chain with the poor slave Taita might not have been out of place. Nevertheless, I had to applaud my mistress's cunning and statesmanship. She had transformed Lord Acker, who had been potentially one of her most dangerous enemies, into an ardent and loyal adherent who would prove his value to her many times in the years ahead. She had a way with all men, and was gaining in statecraft each day. The taming of Lord Acker and the discovery of the route across the bight had secured our rear, and we could go on above the 4th cataract with high spirits and brave heart. We had not travelled more than a month before we realised how our fortunes had changed and how the goddess had made good her promise. It was clearer each day that we had come through the worst. The desert was behind us at last, and the broad, smooth flow of the river turned into the south once more and carried us into a land such as none of us had seen before. It was here that for the first time many of our company witnessed the miracle of rain, although of course I had seen it in the lower kingdom. They had never seen water fall from the sky. The rain beat down into our upturned and astonished faces, while the thunder rolled across the heavens and the lightning blinded us with its white fire. These copious and regular rains engendered a new and exciting landscape, the like of which we could only wonder at. On either bank of the Nile, as far as we could see from the deck of the leading galley, stretched a broad savanna grassland. This magnificent plain, rich with grazing for our horses, set no boundaries to the range of our chariots. We could drive out at will with no dunes or rocky hills to block our progress. This was not the only blessing that the goddess had bestowed. There were trees. In the narrow valley that was our home, there might once have been forests, no man could tell, but they had fallen centuries before to the appetite and axes of man.